You're listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. Hosted by business and political expert Jay Amernick, political visionary and entrepreneur Rick Raddatz, and me, journalist in all media Heather Vail, The Political Fix reveals the answers we're all looking for. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern at politicalfixradio.com. And welcome to The Political Fix on this Wednesday, November the 12th. Wow, we're getting into wintertime now, but it's still nice and sunny in Las Vegas. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Jay is a strategic planner who helps clients create and implement plans, goals, tactics, and benchmarks, and he is also the bridge in Nevada for Israeli companies looking to expand businesses into the U.S. He also has a development lab creating smartphone apps and other inventions. Rick Raddatz is a serial entrepreneur and internet marketer with a degree in philosophy. He's come up with a political development known as The Solution, and that solution is to cap and prioritize government spending. I'm Heather Vail, also known as The Unwrapper. I'm an interviewer, videographer, and journalist in all media. Guys, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey.
Good.
Good.
Good morning. Missed you last week.
Yeah, thanks. I was cavorting in New York City, doing video interviews at AdTech. So, every few months I fly around the country and have a little whirlwind interview series with a bunch of vendors at various trade shows in the internet marketing community. So, yeah, that was fun. In and out. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am.
Yeah.
And I'm back. Yeah. So Jay's apparently feeling the effects of some celebrations or something. So what's going on with you?
I had a very long night because I had the I had a very important meeting, and then went from that to the opening, the reopening of Emeril Lagasse's restaurant at the MGM. I have no idea how I got on the list and how I was invited, but I was, and I went, and it was wonderful. And then after that, there was another event at Hyde at the Bellagio.
Oh, you know, I think you got invited because they said, "Hey, that Jay Amernick guy who's on that Political Fix show, he's really cool."
So anything's entirely possible.
Yeah.
I don't make waves. I'm just like,
they left me off the list, but you know, anyway.
So I behave myself at these own things.
Well, the big news here is that it's finally snowing in Denver.
Snowing. Excuse me.
Yeah. We usually get snow a month earlier. Maybe even as early as September sometimes, but,
really?
This year, not until November, what is it? 18th. Yeah.
It's not
is that
the 18th.
Even up in the mountains?
This is the 12th.
Well, the mountains got snow a little bit earlier, but not a lot. Not a lot. The ski season's off to a slow start, I think.
Okay. So do you go skiing?
I have much in the past. I don't know about this year so much.
Okay. I have never in my life been downhill skiing. I have been cross-country skiing when I was a kid, and I have not done that in probably 30 years, 40 years. I don't know how long.
Downhill definitely beats cross-country, because cross-country, you're doing all the work. In downhill, the machine pulls you up and gravity pulls you down, so it's, like, awesome.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. But is skiing very big in Canada? I would think it would be.
Well, in places.
Well, yeah, it depends if there's mountains or not. Yeah, it depends. Depends what kind of hillage you have in the area. For us, it was like we used toboggans instead. So,
oh dear God.
But however, my boyfriend likes to ski, so maybe I will go this year, Utah or something. But
we have skiing here in Nevada.
We have skiing at Mount Charleston. Yes, we do. He said he learned on that slope, but it's not as cool as Brian Head in Utah. So.
Well, Heather, you're welcome to use my my vacation house up in Breckenridge if you want.
Oh yeah, I remember that house. That was the next internet millionaire jailhouse.
Yes, it was.
Cool. Okay. Well, if I get that far, as far as Colorado, thank you. That would be awesome.
Sure.
All right. So, Rick, tell us, what is the solution?
The solution is cap and prioritize. We're going to cap government spending so the right likes it. Okay, nice and capped. And then we're going to take what's left, trillions of dollars, and we're going to prioritize it, rank it from top to bottom. So the most important spending is on top and the least important spending is on the bottom. And what happens is ideas are forced to compete. And yeah, bad ideas get pushed off the cliff, allowing us to fund good ideas. And then the good ideas get pushed off the cliff, and we can fund better ideas. And the better ideas get pushed off the cliff, and we can fund great ideas, and so on and so on. And so what we're having here is a machine that constantly improves government spending in a way that the left will love, because it's about helping people better and better with the money that we do have. So that's called cap and prioritize. It unites the values of the right and left and center, because this is a fiscally conservative and socially progressive government.
So you're talking about better and better ideas, and I'm just picturing lemmings.
Yeah, that would be a great name for the movement, the lemming movement.
Help us push ideas off the cliff.
we push the ideas off the cliff. That's right. I'll have to work on that. I just bought another domain name, but maybe that one's better. So thank you very much for that. It is about lemmings. It's about all these ideas that are inside government. Some are good, some are bad. And we want the good ideas to push off the bad ideas. That's what it's all about.
Okay.
Yes. I would suggest it's not just the ideas themselves. It's actually the how they're tactically executed. You know, we could say it's a good idea to feed the homeless. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of organizations that allegedly do that. Some not so good, some very good. The idea is that the ones that are not so good either shape up or become the lemmings and are off the cliff.
Exactly.
Well, I would argue it's not so much that it's good to feed the homeless, but it's good to teach the homeless how to feed themselves.
Well, it's a combination. Because
you start off feeding them so they don't die, and
yeah,
then you teach
exactly
them how to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The difference here is that you have to separate the people who need help forever because they just truly are incapable for some biological or mental reason, whatever they got going on.
Yeah.
That's one group. And then there's a group that, with the right education and the right kind of momentum, they could achieve escape velocity, to bring in another metaphor, and they could fly on their own. So how do we get them there? Well, promising them food forever and rent forever and healthcare forever, that's not a way to motivate them to fly on their own. So we have to offer all these services for a time, but let them know that they will also go away after a time, and how long that is, we have to figure out. But I'm reminded of a study, I think it was in Denmark or Finland, in one of those northern European countries there, where they used to have 5-year unemployment benefits, and people would get jobs in 5 years and 3 months. And then they changed it to 4 years, and then people would get jobs in 4 years and 3 months, and then 3 years and 3 months, 2 years. And finally, I think they ended up at 1 year, and people would get jobs in 1 year and 3 months, because when you finally realize that you're not going to get any help anymore, you're out of the help, then it takes about 3 months to get a good job that you like. And so that's what people do.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And I don't know why they would turn down the free money. I mean, who wants to work and make the same amount of money when they can just sit around and make the...
Well, no, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are, but I'm sure that you don't make a whole lot of money on unemployment. Am I correct? I don't know the numbers. I really don't know like how much somebody gets.
No, but not having to work, you don't need a lot of money to live. I mean,
yeah.
if you got a small apartment and you got some food and health care insurance, then and if the emergency room will do, then because they won't turn you away, then you're kind of set in terms of just surviving. And
yeah,
with TV and internet, you can relax and party and communicate and enjoy a form of life. And if it's all paid for, you're done. You're retired.
You know, Rick,
yeah.
I have a feeling that your audio is not coming through on the Hangout because you're not popping up when you talk.
Oh, really?
I think we're only hearing you on the radio and not on the Hangout. Just an observation. Jay, can you say something?
Yes, I'm saying something right now. This is a test.
Okay, no, neither of you guys are popping up. This is so weird.
Well, you guys are switching, and my Hangout says I have audio, so I think we're good.
Okay, well, I have
it's
a feeling
you,
that the recording is going to be just me. Just saying.
Okay. Okay, Heather? If you click on,
I'm going to manually switch us.
No. When you manually switch, you see a little line around the box.
Yes.
Click on that box, and remove the line.
I don't have the line, Rick. I've been doing this for a long time. I know how to run a Hangout. I know about. It used to be blue boxing. Now it's just a white box. So now I am going to manually switch us because it's not automatically switching this time for some reason.
Okay.
All right.
And it's almost top story time, is it not?
It is, yeah. Okay. You guys
I think Heather needs a little practice switching. So Jay, you're going to count.
This has now become a Google Hangout tutorial.
Okay, Jay, you're going to count even numbers. I'll count odd numbers. One.
All right. Two.
Three.
Four.
Five.
Six.
Seven.
Eight.
Nine.
Ten.
Let's go a little faster to challenge Heather, but okay.
Okay.
Why are you?
We were seeing if you could switch between us.
Not each number. You're getting switched like every few numbers.
And Sesame Street will be right back after these important messages.
Okay, so Heather, what's the top story?
All right, so top story is a groundbreaking agreement was struck today by the United States and China, and it puts the world's two worst polluters on a faster track to curbing the heat-trapping gases blamed for global warming. With the clock ticking on a worldwide climate treaty, the two countries sought to move beyond their troubled history as environmental adversaries and to spur other nations. The U.S., a chief proponent of the prospective treaty, is setting an ambitious goal to stop pumping as much carbon dioxide into the air through the burning of coal, oil, and gas. China, whose appetite for cheap energy has grown along with its burgeoning economy, agreed for the first time to a self-imposed deadline of 2030, for when its emissions will top out. But it wasn't clear how either the U.S. or China would meet their goals, or whether China's growing emissions until 2030 would negate any reductions in the U.S. Still, the dual announcements from President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping, unveiled today in Beijing, came as a shock to environmentalists who had wanted such action, but they really didn't think it was going to happen. They thought that China's reluctance and Obama's weakened political standing might interfere with it. In Washington, Republicans were equally taken aback, accusing Obama of saddling future presidents with an unrealistic burden. And we've heard that accusation before. The deal had actually been hashed out behind the scenes for months. And during the 2 days of talks last year at the Sunnylands Estate in California, Obama and Xi reached an agreement on pursuing the reduction of hydrofluorocarbons that are used in refrigerators and insulating foams. A few months later, the U.S. and China finalized the deal to seek the elimination of the potent gases. Obama broached the idea of pursuing the joint plan in a letter to Xi 9 months ago, according to officials, and that sparked secret discussions between the U.S. and Chinese officials. The fight against climate change has become a central facet of the legacy that Obama is hoping to leave behind. Under this agreement, Obama set a goal to cut U.S. emissions between 26 and 28% by 2025, compared with 2005 levels, so over a 20-year period. Officials have said the U.S. is already on track to meet the earlier goal that he had already set, which was to lower emissions 17% by 2020. So this new revised goal means the U.S. would be cutting pollution roughly twice as fast during a 5-year period starting in 2020. Developing nations like India and China have long balked at being on the hook for climate change as much as wealthy nations like the U.S. that have been polluting for much longer. But China analysts said Beijing's willingness to cap its future emissions and to put Xi front and center signaled a significant turnaround. That's the top story. What do you think, Jay?
First of all, I don't believe the U.S. is the top polluter in the world. I think China and India and Russia are. And I think we're somewhere behind. Those may be old statistics I'm thinking of, but last time I checked.
I don't know how old they could be if they're saying that India and China have not been polluting as long or as hard as the U.S.
Well, because
we're
talking about the Industrial Revolution. So India didn't have an Industrial Revolution back in the, you know.
Right. So you think
early
that 1900s. You think they've caught up but surpassed the U.S.?
Well, okay, aggregate, of course we have polluted more. But as far as what's going on now, I believe India is pumping more into the atmosphere.
No, you're talking about CO2 emissions or pollution overall?
I think it's pollution overall.
Yeah, because I have Wikipedia up here, and the CO2 emissions, 2012, China had 9.8, because a bunch of zeros behind it. 9.8, we were at 5.1, India's 1.9, Russia 1.7, Japan 1.3.
That's just CO2, though.
That's just CO2.
Yeah. There's a lot of industrial waste in Russia and a lot of industrial waste in India as well.
Yeah.
First of all, the Republicans are actually spouting nonsense about burdening a future president with unrealistic goals. If they in fact happen to be unrealistic, a future president can toss them out. We get to do anything short of a constitutional amendment is pretty much negotiable.
Well, it's not even a treaty, right? I mean, it's just the president claiming a goal.
It's almost like an MOU. I mean, it's which is a
memorandum
of understanding.
It's an agreement.
Okay.
However,
but it's not a treaty, though.
Well, but I mean, the Senate hasn't ratified it. So, I mean, there's even if the Senate ratifies something, it doesn't mean that we're held to it. It just means that we're promising them. So this doesn't even amount to an official promise of the U.S. It's just one president saying it's his personal goal, and what's he going to do? Use executive powers to make it happen? I mean, he can't. I guess with the way Congress has delegated its regulatory powers to all these different commissions, I guess the president does have the power to impose regulations under those rules. So that's interesting.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I would like to see what China actually does before we start, you know, diving headfirst into this.
Well, China hasn't really committed to doing anything much until 2030. So
exactly,
we can't wait to see what they do because our deadline is 5 years before that. So
someone could make the argument that China is wanting us to put all these regulations in place, which will weaken our economy further and make them stronger. And then by 2030, you know, it's Lucy pulling the football from Charlie Brown. So one could make that argument. I'm not necessarily making that argument, but it's entirely possible.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can finalize the discussion on this and then move on to Inside Perspective with Jay Emmernick. So we'll be right back with you on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with my co-hosts Jay Emmernick and Rick Raddatz. And before the break, we were talking about the top story, which is a new agreement between the United States and China to reduce pollution, including CO2 emissions and hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs.
Get the camera off her.
Three times
all right,
fast.
Guys, so we didn't finish that discussion. Anything to add?
I'll add something. China already has this really, really bad pollution problem, okay? And the government's trying, I believe, in earnest to clean things up a bit in that country. So in a way, I don't think China really agreed to anything because they already have this as their own goal. That's what they want to do internally. So now I don't know the details. So maybe this is more of an agreement than I'm guessing it is. But the way Obama seems to negotiate worldwide contracts and so on, like the reset button for Russia, is that Obama seems to have this theory of let's all be nice, good citizens of the world, and we'll lead by example in this case. We'll lead by following. We'll lead from behind in every other way, but in this case, we'll lead by example and we'll commit to something strong and cut, and then everyone else pretends to and then doesn't. So it would not surprise me that's the same thing is happening right here.
Yeah. Okay. So Jay, what are your comments on that?
It's not a terrible goal. It's a little bit utopian and Pollyannish, but it's not a terrible. I mean, if it in a perfect world, you know, but it's not, and sometimes behaving like that on the world stage gets you and your country taken advantage of.
All right. So, what does this mean in terms of cap and prioritize?
Well, cap and prioritize is the same structure as cap and trade. Okay, it's a cap and trade as it being applied to carbon production or other kinds of pollution, depending on your definition of pollution. And cap and prioritize is we're applying it to government spending. Okay, but the idea is the same. So the more people understand cap and trade and living within sustainable limits environmentally, the more people, I hope, in time will understand that we need to live within fiscal limits sustainably. And so it's really the same question of where should we set the limits, and do we agree that there even should be limits? We have to have that fight first, and then pick reasonable limits and live within them.
Okay. All right. So should we move on now to inside perspective? What do you think?
Sure.
Sure thing.
All right. All right, so we're going to hear Inside Perspective with Jay Amernick, because Jay is our resident government insider, and he has a perspective that's different than everybody else on this show. So take it away, Jay.
Okay, this is actually almost a continuation of last week, this actually applies to both the left and the right, but right now, since the Democrats did not do so well in this last election. This is really about them. And the thing is, you cannot have it both ways. Okay, you can't. Every time the Republicans win, you can't say there was voter suppression and all this other nonsense. You can't say it's because the Koch brothers bought every election, because sometimes Democrats win. So did the Koch brothers not buy that election? It none of that makes any sense. You cannot have it both ways. You can't cry. Sour grapes when your side loses. It happens that the pendulum swings back and forth, and right now it swung in the direction of the Republicans. And I would say next time around, when the Democrats win, the Republicans can't go crying and say they cheated, there was voter suppression, they rigged the polls, there was a mistake with the things and the thing and the thing. It's nonsense. You can't do that. And until we have faith in our electorate and say they voted for this, this is the outcome, live with it. That's it, until then. And here's how cap and prioritize. The way it falls into that is that, again, once cap and prioritize is in place, we will be having much more reasoned discussions, and we won't be talking about all this nonsense, and we'll get to the real meat of it, and we'll be a much smarter country for it.
I think I was the one who introduced the pendulum theory a few weeks ago. So, well, Jay, you're actually agreeing with one of my
The pendulum theory is a few thousand years old.
Yeah.
No, I'm the one that said, okay, look, guys, let's look at the history and see like how long has each party been in, and the pendulum always swings back and forth.
Sure. And now it's swung.
So now you agree with me. Okay.
I didn't agree with you.
Okay.
Sometimes it takes longer to swing, but I think that also has to do with the way we get information now. Think about this. I mean, before the internet, before Facebook, everything else, the information was not flying fast and furious the way it is now.
Yeah. Okay. So, Rick, what are your comments on Jay's inside perspective?
Well, first, I disagreed that Jay did not disagree with your disagreement about the pendulum theory. I think he's totally wrong about that. But seriously,
lost.
So Jay, what was your point?
My point is that you can't have it both ways. You can't say the whole system's broken because there's voter suppression, but then a Democrat wins. So what, was there no voter suppression there? Or
this reminds me of something I saw Grover Norquist say one time. He said, "Look, like voter fraud only matters if the election's close, okay? So let's not make it close." let's pick the right candidates, let's have the right messages, let's win this election. What's weird in the last couple election cycles is that we had a big win for the Democrats, then a big win for the Republicans, and a big win for the Democrats, and a big win for the Republicans. It happens to be coinciding with the midterms versus the presidential cycle, which is good for the Democrats and bad for the Republicans on the presidential side. But it's good for the Republicans on in terms of controlling Congress. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens in 2016. But the I agree with you in general that complaining about how the game is played is just silly, because the rules of the game are wrong. Okay, you gotta fix the rules. You gotta fix the incentives. It doesn't matter how much people spend, because they're spending it on both sides, like you said.
Right.
What matters is, can you buy political power at all? You shouldn't be able to. Not much. Okay, if we want to tamp that down as much as we can, and so we need to have a capped budget, and we need ideas to compete for money in a prioritized budget, because when the spending is prioritized, that's where you can't buy favors anymore, at least in terms of spending.
Right. Right.
So the question of regulations, but you gotta win each battle one at a time. And long as I brought it up, just to mention regulations. I have this Pollyanna-ish vision that once government spending is capped and prioritized and we start to see spending constantly improve, then we as a nation will start to realize that there are better ways of helping people than mandating a certain service level or mandating a minimum wage. Because when you mandate a minimum wage, people who are not worth that wage don't get a job. And so we can subsidize them through a cap and prioritized budget so they can still get help, but now they can also have a job. And they can learn, you learn things on a job, you don't learn any other way. And so we can start to pull back from the regulation circus that we have right now once we fix government spending. That's my theory.
That is exactly your theory.
Yeah.
that is your theory in action.
Yeah. I believe the world constantly improves on average.
Mm-hmm.
Humanity does. And so we're going to get there. We're going to get to this great place, better than we have right now, as good as we have it right now. It's going to get better. It won't be in a straight line. We may not always be in the lead, but humanity as a whole will keep figuring things out. And so eventually we will figure out this is my rational excuse for why I'm an optimist, is that on average, good things work and they stick around, and things that fail fade away. And so we end up, even by accident, constantly improving.
Yeah, well, it's funny, right? It's, and especially when we have to, I'm reminded of something out of The Art of War. Sun Tzu says that if you basically put your army on what's called death ground, which means they literally have no choice but to fight the other army. They can't retreat. There's nowhere to retreat to. They literally have to stand and fight. They will. And come and be victorious. The same thing here is like when we really need to come up with something, we do. When it comes down to it, we're going to have to come up with an alternative to fossil fuels. We're going to run out of them, and once we're on that so-called death ground, when people can't, when gas is now at such a premium, it's $1,000 a gallon. God forbid that should happen. We'll have to come up with something, because we're on that killing ground, or death ground. Sorry.
Wasn't that a movie with Mad Max? Yeah.
What?
The Killing Fields? That's a whole different thing.
No, having no fuel and society.
Yeah, the road war.
Yeah, that was. Yeah, a lot of the post-apocalyptic films and books have fuel as a fought-over thing, because you don't have the cars, and you don't have the refineries anymore, so you're fighting over whatever fuel is left.
Yeah. George Miller, Australian director, directed that movie. Yeah, it's an interesting look at a very sort of dismal future, actually.
Yeah, well, people tend to like looking at dismal futures for some reason, but I like Rick's optimistic future. That was
yeah.
pretty inspiring.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, guys. So let's take another quick break, and we'll be right back with you in a few minutes on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail, here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. If you want to call in and join our discussion, go ahead and give us a call at 888-627-6008. That's 1-888-627-6008. Before the break, we were talking about the inside perspective with Jay Amernick, which is that you can't have it both ways. You can't complain about how elections are rigged on one side but not the other, correct?
Yes, you can't. Right, the Democrats can't complain that there's voter suppression, and then next time around when they win, they miraculously the voter suppression that they complained about was gone. It's nonsense. And again, because then the Republicans are going to claim about voter fraud.
Well, okay. I'm going to argue with you a little bit,
Jay. Okay.
And then,
just a little bit.
Okay. I'm going to have a theory here that the corruption is more on the left than the right. Okay, I'm not saying the right is absent of corruption.
See, that seems backwards, because it seems like the way that the parties are presented, it seems like the right is more corrupt than the left.
Well, I think you're confusing greedy and corrupt. You see, the political right has this messaging problem in that if you want a limited government, you keep being accused of throwing grandma off the cliff. Okay? And so you seem greedy. And so things like corruption, you know, the attack sticks, whether it's true or not. But and that, by the way, is why the Republicans have to go with cap and prioritize. Because if you prioritize a budget, then all the poor grandmas are safe because they're prioritized on top. Grandmas like it on top. And, and then the only grandmas that get thrown over the cliff. Yeah, the only grandmas that get thrown over the cliff with a prioritized budget are the rich grandmas. And rich grandmas have like jetpacks and parachutes, so they're fine. And so that's why the Republicans have to go with this cap and prioritize message, so that they stop being accused of being greedy. But if you look at what Republicans are trying to do, they're trying to limit government. They're trying to stop the expansion of government and so on. And these are philosophies and approaches that lend themselves towards doing less things. Okay, it's a naturally less corrupt philosophy. Whereas the attempt to do more through government, okay, lends itself to a message to the grassroots, you know, the mass populations who are needy and need help, and they want help, and they believe it's greedy to not help, and so there's more motivation to play games at the grassroots level than there is on the right. I'm just going to say that. I think there's different kinds of corruption. I guess on the right hand side, I think you end up having kind of like bigger scale corruption with like partnerships with certain industries. The left has some of that too, but then I think there's more low level corruption on the left than there is on the right.
Okay, interesting theory, Jay. What do you think?
He's actually not too far off the mark. Right, because when it comes to when they did actually find voter fraud and things like that on a small scale, it was like people who had passed away were voting, which is, you know, quite miraculous, actually. And it turned out they were voting for Democrats. There were also some issues with that at some point. People who were donating to Hillary Clinton's campaign were like homeless, and it was just they were sort of spreading the money out because their limits as to what an individual can do.
Okay, so you're saying that dead people vote left?
Yes, they do. They're worried about the afterlife rights. What I'm saying is when it has been uncovered, it has been that they have found, and again, these are small scale things.
Do we have stats on this? Do we have stats? Can we look this up?
Are there stats? It's probably more news stories than there are actual statistics. And again, I would also suggest trying to find something that's non-biased, like, you know, trying to find something that's on,
Rick, take it to Wikipedia.
Which is always accurate.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Well, in this case, I'm going to search for, like, right-leaning voter fraud.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
why are you searching for right leaning when you guys are saying that?
Well, because we want to. And the other piece for me is I would actually, someone needs to educate me in all seriousness about the identification thing, because who it's and I'm being serious. I'm not being facetious. I'm not being a wise guy. But what who doesn't have an identification of some sort? I'm not saying a driver's license, because even without a driver's license, you get an ID card. And I believe it's a crime to not have identification. It's vagrancy, I believe. You should have some kind of identification.
So you're saying that people are walking in and not showing identification and voting as...
No, because they're not required to. But I think when you go
to the polls to vote on election day, you don't show ID?
No. I walk in, and here's the thing, is that there's so much early voting now, right, that, you know, it's like a month-long process.
So are you saying that technically I could vote, even though I'm not American, I'm not supposed to vote, but I could just walk in and cast a ballot randomly?
Not randomly, because what I do is I go in, it says on the booklet they give me, I'm in precinct, whatever it was, I can't remember offhand, you know, 1735 or something like that. I walk up to that table, they have a book there. A ledger, and in it is my name, my address, and then a copy of my signature. So, which is foolish anyway, because all you have to do is, someone would have to do is copy it. But I say, oh, I'm Jay Amernick, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, here, sign here. They hand me a ballot, and I'm off to the races. Now, with all this early voting, what if somebody did that at one of the early voting places, right? And then I come in on election day, because that's when I like to vote. I like to be part of the thing. And I come and say, no, you've already voted. And I'm like, no, I haven't.
What would you do at that point?
I would think about suing the federal government for a violation of my constitutional rights.
That would be a good
story.
For
a great deal of money.
Can we do that? Let's have a homeless person next year vote as you.
Homeless people can vote. They're allowed to vote. They're citizens of the United States. They can vote.
They don't need to have an address? What does it say for address? No address?
You have to register. You know, that's actually a good question. I don't know if you don't have an address, what happens. But again, in all seriousness, to not have an ID, like, how many people does that really affect? That's what I want to know. And I'm being serious. If someone could tell me who, you know, I see the stories to me that I see are anecdotal. It's one, you know, old woman who's been voting since, you know, 19, you know, the first time she could vote, 1920, and on, and all of a sudden is retired, doesn't have a driver's license anymore, if there was voter ID, she wouldn't be able to vote. I'm like, well, then get an ID card. You know, if it's 20 bucks or whatever it is, then you could say, well, I don't have 20 bucks. Okay, then maybe the government should subsidize people who really can't afford an ID card, but everyone should have an identification card. I think, at very least. What if there's an emergency? What if, you know, forget voter fraud, but emergency or to prove who they are.
If you go to the emergency room at the hospital, you need to show ID, so.
It's different. It's not a government-run facility. It's a private facility. They can do whatever they want.
Okay.
So when it's, the issue here is that they're worried about, they're worried about someone not having an identification card, which just makes no sense to me. Okay. Because clearly it's an issue.
Well, it's all political because the people who don't have IDs are going to be the more poor people, the people who generally tend to vote more Democratic, and so the Democrats, of course, have to fight this effort, whether their points are pure on principle or not. And to the political right, they have all these examples of voter fraud. They have examples of the Acorn company doing all this false registration and so on. And then there's Illinois politics, where dead people do vote routinely. So that's all the excuse the Republicans need to fight for more clear voter ID, which clearly benefits them. So it's political on both sides.
But if everyone has an ID, so the people who, you say the poor who don't have an ID card, so the government should give them one. It's really not that big a deal, and I don't know how many people it actually affects who don't have an identification card. I have no idea. Who actually would go out and vote.
Well, I have another theory, which is that if you're too poor or too disconnected from society to have an ID, it's probably a good thing for you not to vote anyway. It's still a right, but you know what? There's got to be a limit, and we got to draw a reasonable line. And if you can't go out and get an ID card, you know, then you're not a productive citizen. You're not pulling your weight. And so I actually personally agree with the founders and the general public at the time, where it was like you had to be a contributing member of society in order to have the right to vote. It's not that everyone has the right to vote. You need to be a contributing member of society. And back in the day, this was up to the states. It wasn't a federal thing. But the states mostly said you got to be a property owner before you vote. I've heard some people say that, the more you pay in taxes, the more votes you should get. I've heard some people say that if we average out the cost of government per person, it's like X thousands of dollars a year, like $10,000 a year or whatever it is, okay? So if you're not contributing that much in taxes, you don't get a vote. Meaning if you're a net receiver of services instead of a net producer, you shouldn't get a vote. So there's a lot of different theories here about what truly is a fair vote. The idea being that if you're on the receiving side of government assistance for that period of time, maybe there's a perverse incentive for you to vote to get more help. Okay. And so I don't know what the right answer is, but I know that it's more complicated than people make it out to be. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I don't think that many people vote that it would be an incentive. That's the sort of frightening thing too. I mean, it's usually like 33% of the people who are registered to vote or something like that, which is not even 100% of the eligible.
Yeah. So
population.
The odds of someone trying to vote and not being able to vote because they don't have ID are incredibly slim in the first place.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The stories that I hear are anecdotal, so I want like sort of the honest. Like, how many people actually do not have an identification?
Yeah,
Rick, did you get any stats?
I looked it up, but there's so much, so much noise in the.
That's what I was saying.
I wasn't able to find anything I believed in. So.
All right.
That's what
okay,
I said.
So let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have the outside perspective, aka Rick's rant. So we'll be right back with you on the Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with my co-hosts, Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. And before the break, we were talking about the inside perspective with Jay Amernick. Now we're going to hear the other side of the coin. This is what we call the outside perspective, hosted by Rick Raddatz, also known as Rick's Rant. Take it away, Rick.
Well, it's affectionately known as Rick's Rant, isn't that?
Well...
You used to say that. Have we lost the affection?
I don't know about affection. You know, it depends.
We've lost the affection
about you
of the
that
show?
Day.
Okay, here we go. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Lay it on.
What was it? I just forgot. I had this great one prepared.
Your rant today is about affection.
No. Okay, I remember. No, my rant today is about, you know how when you come out with a new idea, and this new idea has a lot of benefits versus the old ideas, right? But then you get these people who shoot you down because your new idea isn't perfect. Well, of course it's not perfect. Nothing is perfect. But is it better than the old idea? That's the question. And so to tie this back to the show, cap and prioritize. That's our new idea, right? We're going to cap the government just like the right wants and then take the money that's left, trillions of dollars, prioritize it. So we help the people who need help most, and we help them better and better and better over time through competition, okay? The right gets freedom as taxes go down. The left gets social justice as the effectiveness of spending goes up. Okay, this is a great new idea. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's so much better than the old ideas. Okay? And yet, time and time again, when I'm talking to people, they attack the idea because it doesn't do this or doesn't do that from their perspective. Well, they're attacking it from the ideal, from this lack of perfection. And when I ask them, well, what about the current government? Does the current government do what you just attacked me about? And they say, well, no. I says, well, there you go. Okay? Is this idea better? Yeah, it's better. But it doesn't do that. I don't want to support it. So it's just funny how people attack new ideas from perfection, and they don't get motivated. But they really have to instead, and maybe this is on us, we have to do a better job making sure that people compare the new idea to the past and say, this is better.
That makes sense.
I'm actually agreeing with Rick here.
So what are some of the attacks that people have about the solution?
Well, it's like some people, it all depends on where they're coming from. Some people will say, like on the political right, that, oh, I'm being this foolish idealist because you'll never get the left to agree. And meanwhile, I ask them, you know, what do they want? And if it's someone on the libertarian right, for example, they'll want this really aggressive cap and say, government's just bad, we shouldn't do it at all, and all the incentives are wrong, and so we need a capped government, we need like almost no government. And I'm like, well, dude, you and I have the same sense of what the cap needs to be. It needs to be pretty aggressive and airtight, trending towards a smaller and smaller government. So we agree on the cap, but I have, in addition to the cap, a message to the left. We're not going to get everybody on the left, but some people on the left will say, yeah, we like this idea. It makes sense. And so my idea is more viable than your idea, but you're attacking me for viability. And it happens a lot, actually. When I go to these Tea Party events, they have some weird idea of a cap, and they claim that my idea is idealistic.
Okay. And Jay, what do you think?
No, that goes back to what I've been saying about ideologues all along. They have this sort of set idea that they believe that something that is in fact not fact, more their opinion and theory, they believe it is fact. So literally, Rick is telling them that water is not wet.
Yeah.
In their mind, that is what's happening, and again, it happens on the left too. In this case, it's the right. It's the libertarian right. Literally to them, Rick's idea is so insane and out there because it doesn't fall under their parameters of what they believe to be truth, when in fact it is just their opinion and just theory.
My favorite example is take a very traditional conservative, okay, not a libertarian, a conservative, okay, religious or not, but they're conservative.
Yeah.
And this person, this person might agree with me 100% that we need a cap government. Okay, yeah, we're on the same page there. No problem. Love your cap. Great cap. And should we take the money that's left and prioritize it? Because that further limits what government can do. And they're like, yes, we should absolutely prioritize it. All in favor of prioritizing. And I say, great, because if we do those two things, the competition will create a government where ideas that help people better win, and then we'll get better and better at helping people. That's the effective pursuit of social justice. And they'll say, no, that is not the purpose of government. Government has no business being in the helping people business, and we shouldn't do it. I don't like your idea. So they agree with all the parts, but they don't agree that government should help people, so they therefore just go back to their way of thinking, which, I don't know, isn't thinking, I guess. So that's my favorite example, because they agree with me all the way there. And the left does this a little bit too, although usually they have a problem with the cap.
Of course.
So usually this is more on the right, because the right agrees on the cap, and who's against prioritizing? Nobody. Nobody good anyway. So they agree the whole way, and then they stop short when they realize that their own philosophy leads to social justice pursued by the government. It's their own philosophy. And it's just funny.
Yeah. Whenever I take on ideologues, this is why.
Yeah.
It is going to be probably one of the biggest pre-stumbling blocks to cap and prioritize. Right before legislating it, I think this is the big problem, is getting the buy-in from everybody and having everybody. The problem is that, and I would suggest this, is that the ideologues aren't listening. They are.
Yeah.
They have it set. They have it set in their head, and then at one point when it goes off of the of their sort of. Of their out of their realm, it turns into a white noise. It turns into static to them.
So I think what that leads us to then is that to make this movement happen, we shouldn't try to get one side or the other or the middle on board. Instead, we should expect to get 2 or 3% of every side. We're going to have some libertarians and some conservatives and some moderates on the right, some independents, some moderates on the left, some progressives on the left. Maybe even a few communists, and we'll get a little bit of all those groups on board, and we'll form our own movement, our own coalition, our own army that does get it, and then we have the fight. Right now the Republicans and Democrats have to try to convince the independents to step up to one side or the other and convince their base to vote, and that's the game right now. We have a similar thing in that we have to convince people to abandon that whole fight and have a different fight. So we're going to get people that agree with us naturally at first, and in some ways those will be easier to get, and then we have the same tough fight that any other political party or movement has, which is to convince people who actually think differently, one by one, to come on board. That's going to be hard.
Yeah, there must be a way to tap into basically what you guys are describing here is cognitive dissonance, because people cannot have in their mind an idea that conflicts with what they think the idea should be. So once they already have their mind set and you introduce something, no matter how logical it is, it's like does not compute. So the approach might be to convince them how much it is like what they already believe, and
yeah,
then just slide in that little extra part.
Yeah, it's got to be it might work that this is the right compromise. It's like, look, it's not what you want ideally.
See, that's what I've been saying all along, compromise.
Maybe this is the right compromise.
Yes, because people understand compromise. They know in a marriage, in a relationship, in a friendship, in a business transaction, there's always compromise.
Well,
that's how you arrive at win-win scenarios.
Not in a marriage. Are you kidding me? I'm right. Every time.
No. If anything, your wife is right all the time. That's how men survive marriages. It's either the woman's always right or they compromise. It's never that the man's always right. Never. No.
Well, actually, I will say that actually ideologues don't know compromise, because again, what you're trying to convince them of is to all of a sudden believe that water is not wet. That's the issue. So for them, there is no compromise in what they believe to be the truth. When they stop thinking that their opinion and theory is that and believe it to be factual.
Instead of taking someone 90 degrees or 180 degrees, it's much easier to take them 10 degrees off where they are. So I'm saying tell them all the parts that are exactly what they already believe, and then just introduce that little bit more that is slightly off.
Okay. And then once it goes off, it'll turn into static.
No,
that's
not necessarily.
Challenge.
Only if you're talking to robots. I mean, like...
Ideologues are actually very close to that.
Does not compute. Cognitive dissonance.
Those are your lemmings.
Do not understand.
There's actually an episode of Star Trek where that's how they sort of defeat these robots, by like literally throwing
illogical. Oh yeah, I remember that. They confuse the heck out of the robots, don't they? Blow
right,
up
and then
or
they
something?
Smoke and
the
yeah. It's called I Mud is the name of the episode. And that's how they literally throw just illogic at them, and they flake out. So
yeah.
that's what happens.
Okay. Well, I think when we're dealing with humans, we can just be a little bit more reasonable than the robots who, like, robots. Computers, everything's black or white, off or on. There's no gray area for a computer. So
that's not true anymore. Computers are getting better and better at the probability.
Is it not one and zero? It's ones and zeros. It's still bits and bytes.
No, that's the foundation of it. Okay, but if you look at, like, remember the IBM computer called Watson that played Jeopardy?
Right.
Okay, you know, it got really good at guessing, basically. Now, it was still based on logic. It was still very complicated. But the logic nowadays is getting so sophisticated that it is starting to get closer towards, things that we think only humans can do right now. A good example is a Siri on the iPhone or the equivalent on the Android, where, you know, you can just talk and at real time, it's figuring out what you're saying, even when I'm driving in my convertible with the radio on. Okay, it can still understand human speech and do the right thing. So better and better every year. So
yeah, okay.
You know, don't diss these computers. These computers are actually going to take over.
Okay. All right. That's a movie right there, and that's a whole different episode. We're actually out of time for today,
right,
so we're gonna have to save that theory for next week.
No. Real quick. Imagine all of social services being one computer doling out vouchers. Imagine how much money we'll save. I don't know how much better it'll
be. Yeah, I know. You've talked about the vouchers before. Yeah, that's
one computer running all of social services, giving out vouchers. That's the future.
Okay.
I have one word for you. HAL. Bad idea.
Okay, wait. Now you're opening a whole new can of worms. Save the HAL for next week. We'll talk about vouchers and how the
HAL.
HAL. Oh, HAL. HAL.
Daisy.
Okay.
Daisy.
Sorry, Dave. I can't allow you to do that.
All right. Okay, so we're out of time today. Thank you for joining us on The Political Fix. Check us out at politicalfixradio.com. On behalf of myself, Rick Raddatz, and Jay Amernick, have a great week, and we'll be back with you next week. I'm Heather Vail.
Thank you for listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. On behalf of Rick Raddatz, Jay Amernick, and myself, Heather Vail Goss, we're glad you chose to get your fix with us. We need reform to fix this country, and incentive reform is what will make a difference. The five economies and resources laid out in Pentonomics and the strategies we call cap and prioritize are the focus of Rick's vision of the optimal political future. Every week, we talk about the answers we've dug up among ourselves and with political experts who have the ability to make change happen. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com.